Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Narayanam namaskrita naram cheva narottamam. So, this morning Bhagavatam discussion is taken from Canto 9, Chapter 16, from text 32 down to 37. A series of verses that are very much intimately connected. And the title of the chapter is Lord Parasuram Destroys the Ruling Class. So, please, we request that you move forward a little bit so that there could be some synergy. I don't know what you think about it. You're too far, so get close a little bit. Come and give us your blessings. I know I'm coming from America, but I'm not carrying guns, so you come close. So, text 32. Is that what it's on? Yeah. Yo rapto devaya jena. Deva gaddi shuta pasaha. Deve rapta iti kyataha. Suna sefa tu bhagavaha. Translation. Although Sunapsefa was born in the Bhagavad dynasty, he was greatly advanced in spiritual life, and therefore the demigods involved in the sacrifice protected him. Consequently, he was also celebrated as the descendant of Gadi named Devarata. Please responsibly repeat. And I just go to the next verse. The translation is, when requested by their father to accept Sunapsefa as the eldest son, the elder 50 of the Madhuchandas, the sons of Vishwamitra did not agree. Therefore, Vishwamitra, being angry, cursed them. Quote, may all of you bad sons become malicious. He said, being opposed to the principles of Vedic culture. Unquote. Purport. In Vedic literature, there are names like Malicha and Yavana. The malicious are understood to be those who do not follow the Vedic principles. In former days, the malicious were fewer, and Vishwamitra Muni cursed his sons to become malicious. But in the present age, Kali Yuga, there is no need of cursing, for people are automatically malicious. This is only the beginning of Kali Yuga, but at the end of Kali Yuga, the entire population will consist of malicious, because no one will follow the Vedic principles. At that time, the incarnation of Kalki will appear. Melecha, Nivaha, Nibdani, Kalayasi, Karabalan. He will kill all the Melechas indiscriminately with his sword. I was specifically requested to retreat from 32 to 37. I don't know for what strategic reasons, but I have to do that. 34. When the elder Madhuchandas were cursed, the younger 50, along with the Madhuchanda himself, approached their father and agreed to accept the proposal. Dear father, they said, we shall abide by whatever arrangements you like. 35. Thus, the younger Madhuchandas accepted Sunasepa as your eldest brother and told him, We shall follow your orders. Vishwamitra then said to his obedient sons, because you've accepted Sunasepa as your eldest brother, I am very satisfied. By accepting my order, you have made me a father of worthy sons. And therefore, I bless all of you to become the fathers of sons also. There's a brief purport by Srila Prabhupada. Of the 100 sons, half disobeyed Vishwamitra by not accepting Sunasepa as their eldest brother. But the other half accepted his order. Therefore, the father blessed the obedient sons to become the fathers of sons. Otherwise, they too would have been cursed to be sonless, malicious. 36. Vishwamitra said, O Kusikas, descendants of Kusika, this Devarata is my son and is one of you. Please obey his orders. Or, O King Parikshit, Vishwamitra had many other sons, such as Astaka, Harita, Jaya, and Kratuman. 37, the very last verse. Vishwamitra cursed some of his sons and blessed the others. And he also adopted a son. Thus, there were varieties in the Kusika dynasty. But among all the sons, Devarata was considered the eldest. Oh, Magyan, all protocols observed. We don't want to take you into the deep rituals before discussing the Bhagavatam. You've been doing that every day. So some days we can skip that. Essential points raised here are very pertinent to everyday reality in these very verses. Because sometimes we tend to think that, you know, what we're experiencing in modern day so-called civilization is something new. Or there are things new. But there is nothing new in this universe. Things just keep repeating. History keeps repeating itself. So, from these verses, we find something or some things very interesting. And the last verse, 37, is something that all of you know, adoption. Sometimes, you know, people don't want to hear that word, adoption. I want to go and adopt a child. But even Vishwamitra adopted a child. Can you imagine that? Just a great king. And not that he didn't have any child. He had many children. 100. 100 plus. Yet, he adopted Sunasepa. And he wanted his adopted son to be, to rule his biological children. Can you imagine that? If your parents went to adopt a child, they brought a child, it's not your biological sibling. And your father comes to say, hey boy, Govinda, I want this gentleman, this my adopted child, to rule over you, to take care of everything in this house. What will you do? Tell me. You like it? Yeah. Huh? So, there are so many things recorded in Vedic history. That's one point, adoption. But the adoption itself, I for one find it very difficult to figure out the rationale behind the adoption. Because he had kids. Of course, we understand that Sunasepa was purchased by Harichandra's son. Because Harichandra's son was to be used in the sacrifice, and he was smart. In America, they say, so he's smart. He was smart and he wanted to save his head.
but he wanted to use someone else. But the point is, just like you have heard about these stories over and over again, the point was that the person that was purchased for the sacrifice invoked the mercy of the demigods, whom he was supposed to be sacrificed to. So the demigod saved his life. And it is mentioned in this very section of the Srimad Bhagavatam that this was due to his spiritual purity, spiritual potency. He attained some height in spiritual evolvement. And you know, if you are spiritually evolved, you can do amazing things. You can change what is most undesirable to most desirable. And so this was a situation where he was completely sold out to debt. But even debt rejected him. He said, "You go back." So the demigods, they actually saved his life. So this very Shunasefa, who was adopted by Vishwamitra afterwards, he's been given the power, and Vishwamitra wanted him to rule over his kingdom. But the elders, the 50 elder sons, said, "No way. Who can take this?" In modern day, what Vishwamitra did by not containing his anger or not being able to deal with his anger, of course, we know if you read the Vishnu Purana and the Harivamsa, you see the details of Vishwamitra and, of course, even his birth. And we know that he had a number of conflicts with other people, even Sage Vasistha. And that was born, his encounter, his conflict with Vasistha was born, was rooted in greed. He wanted to take the cow, the wish-fulfilling cow from, you know, Vasistha, and Vasistha was, you know, vehemently opposed to it. And, you know, there was a clash. He thought he could defeat Vasistha, but then, you know, the opposite was the case. So the point is, the rationale behind Vishwamitra's adoption, I find it very difficult to comprehend. And of course, the other point that precedes the other verses here, of course, the whole of this chapter basically deals with two things. It deals with Parasuram's destruction of the Kshatriyas and the descendants of Vishwamitra. So this is some sort of sociological historiography. And then we find that, you know, people think when they're going to study, when they go to university to study sociology or to specialize in sociology as a degree, they think it's something new. But, you know, all of these thoughts, you find all these things in the Vedic literature. So there is nothing really strange to the ardent Vedic scholar. So here, we find that Vishwamitra couldn't contain the refusal of his sons. It's painful, you know, when you give an order to your child. And, you know, one boy was telling me in Pennsylvania, one devotee, he was telling me in Pennsylvania how he vehemently refused to go to public school because of his experiences in public school. He would go to school on Monday, and his peers, his class peers, will come to him and ask him, "What did you do last weekend to agitate your parents?" This is America. You have to give an account of what you did to your peers, to your friends, to agitate your parents the weekend. When you come on Monday, that is the report card. That is the report you're going to give. So, can we compare that to the case of Vishwamitra's children, when they said no, when the father went to adopt, brought some stranger to the home and wanted the stranger to rule over them. They just said, they politely said no. But again, we find that anger is not, it's an ill wind that does no one any good. It simply brings destruction. And we'll find how several cases in Vishwamitra's life, he was not able to deal with his anger. Rupa Goswami mentions that. In fact, in the very first verse of the Parishamrita, he cited anger, indicated that anger was one of the major impediments to organizational leadership. If people want to rule the world, they must try to contain their anger. But sometimes we find people who don't even control their anger and they want to rule the whole world. It doesn't work like that. So, here, a very prominent figure, a ruler like Vishwamitra, was not able to contain his anger. His children offended him and he cursed them. Now, we can't just take every and anything from the Bhagavatam and try to leave it. Because who does what is important. Vishwamitra cursed his sons. Vishwamitra had 101 children. We can say, well, cursing is there in the Bhagavatam. I will also curse my children. If you try that in America, the child will call the police. It's called emotional abuse. The police will get you arrested. Emotional abuse is very rampant in India and Africa. People emotionally abuse their wives, abuse their children like anything. They feel they are the top of the world. They are the breadwinners. They can do anything. For one thing, we have to understand what we have to deal with when we're studying the Vedic literature. There is what basically we will refer to as the breadth of information culture, about the breadth of knowledge. If we take some stuff from the Vedas and we repeat it, that is called the breath. Take for instance, you take a verse in the Bhagavad Gita, Dehi nosmi yata dehe kumaram yavanam jara tata dehantara prati dira satanamuyat. This is, if you repeat this statement, what you have earned so far is just breath information. And anyone can repeat anything. Now, in some of these verses, here, Prabhupada gives some purport. In other words, these are his realizations. These are his interpretations. These are what basically are the underpinnings of the statement, the original statement made in these verses. But his purport is what constitutes, or any other acharya's purport or commentator, is what constitutes the depth of the knowledge. By the time we integrate what Prabhupada himself has mentioned in the purport and the original statement, if we are able to integrate that and implement that in our own lives and relate that to everyday reality, that is the application of the Vedic culture. That is the application of the Vedic information. So the Vaishnava Vedanta is seemingly very simple. A Prabhupada will say, this process of Krishna consciousness is very simple. And one disciple, after struggling so many years, he went to meet Prabhupada and said, you said the process is very simple. Prabhupada responded that it is simple, but it doesn't mean that it's easy. That's it. There are two different things. Something could be simple, but may not be easy. And something could be simple and could also be easy. It depends on who is utilizing the information in applying it to his own life or her own life and in relating that to everyday reality. And so we'll find that Vishwamitra, for one, was temperamental. Although he attained the status of Brahma Rishi after so much of endeavor, and that was also rooted in envy of Vasistha. And so he wanted to be like, you know, like Vasistha. There's nothing wrong in seeing people who are making progress and we try to emulate them. But there is something seriously wrong in seeing people who are making progress and we become envious of them. Because envy itself is a clog in the heart. And when you have a clog, you could have, heart failure. Is it not? You could have heart failure. What's the technical name they call it? they call it when the blood doesn't... heart attack. Cardiac arrest. There's different names. So envy could give the spiritualist a spiritual cardiac arrest. Because it could lead us to so many things, so many pursuits that could be disastrous to our very spiritual cultivation. So we find that in the life of Vishwamitra, he got defeated by Vasistha because, you know, he wanted to seize Vasistha's cow from him. And therefore, it is important for us to learn some lessons from these very verses. And one point is that we take a lesson from Suna Sefa. Lord Krishna mentions, it is mentioned in the Shastra, Mara Krishna Rakaki, Rakaki Krishna Maraki. If Krishna wants to destroy, nobody can save. If Krishna wants to save, no one can destroy. But Krishna does not simply, he's not just a security guard who just saves people. He's not just a security guard. Krishna mentions in the Gita, Sarva Dharma Paritraja, Mamekam Saranam Vraja, Aham Tram, Sarva Papebhyo, Moksha Yishami Masusha. He knows that we may be apprehensive or we may even be afraid of surrendering unto him, but this is the condition to protect us. We have to take shelter of him. And taking shelter of him, we can see vividly in the case of Suna Sefa. He did take shelter of the Antaranga Shakti. He didn't wholly take shelter of the Bahiranga Shakti. And that is why he was saved by the demigods. He was evolved spiritually. And for someone to be evolved spiritually, it means that you are aligning with the Antaranga Shakti. Someone will not be evolved spiritually if he or she is simply aligned with the Bahiranga Shakti. Because those activities, or both activities, are completely different. One is becoming liberated from the clutches of mundane or material incoherences. In another phase, one is becoming more and more entangled in material activities, protecting one's stay in the material universe. Another point we see is that the whole of material life is just full of complications. You may just have a father who is even very wealthy, but you never can tell what is going to happen to you in the next few minutes. He may come up with a decision that could be very much traumatic on your very being, perhaps for a whole lifetime. And you could even have disagreement with your parents. The parents who will call you darling, 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 mine, mine, mine. And then one time they bring up some issue that you completely could be disgusted with and you can't take it. This is what happened here. They were very good parties, father and children, father and sons. But then the father generated an idea that the children didn't want to really align with. And that invoked so much of fury from the father, and he cursed them. So the person who calls you darling, 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 could even the next moment send you to hell, if it is possible. So is it a life worth being jolly of? That everything is unpredictable. You live in a king's palace, and all of a sudden, you are thrown outside into the streets. This is what happened here, more or less. Those who obeyed him, he favored them. Okay, you good boys, I bless you. Oh, you rascals, you disobey my order. But Krishna loves us unconditionally. After giving instructions to Arjuna, he said, deliberate on it. Figure out what you have to do. He didn't say, oh, I told you this. You refuse. I curse you. Krishna never said that. He gave the instructions. He asked Arjuna, figure out what is best for you. In other words, a devotee has to act like Krishna, never to curse people. We never find Krishna or even his pure devotees cursing people. But we find all this cursing saga in the Vedic literature that is rooted in lack of self-control. And one of the angers, one of the aspects of self-control is anger. Rupa Goswami says, we have to be able to control the anger, to be able to integrate properly in the community of living beings or human beings. Anger causes so much of trouble. A man may even call his wife, darling, 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 and the next moment he starts beating up the wife. Oh, yes. I remember my personal assistant in Delhi, he told me a story. And that's right in India here. Father was a well-to-do medical doctor. He himself and his older brother were watching his father abuse their mother. Insults, even physical abuse. So when they graduated from university, they called the father one day and said, Dad, there's a meeting today. There's a meeting. That's what? A meeting. And this one is right in India. No, this is not Purana. It's just, you know, telling you a story just few weeks back. And then these two boys, they told the father, look, thank you very much for training us. We have graduated from our university. We have watched you abuse our mother like anything. I'm talking about this because it has to do with anger. Anger. And they said, now we are big boys. You stop abusing our mother. If you try it again, we'll teach you a lesson. Right from that day, the father never abused his wife. So people have powers and they want to do anything. So suppose the children are also able to counteract with a curse. What would have happened? It would have been a counter-curse versus counter-curse and all this stuff. So what we are saying in essence is that, you know, material world means we will be confronted with some challenges. But we should not resort to taking vengeance or taking the law in our hands to be able to, you know, give the so-called perceived offender, perceived opponent, the so-called appropriate action. And so it is important that we understand what is our limitation. As devotees, are there certain things that we should do? Are there certain things that we shouldn't do? Or should we just read the scriptures and take every story that we hear that, and then whatever the sage, whatever some, you know, some king has done, and then we also follow that? Obviously not. We are practicing to be followers of Rupa Goswami, Rupa Nugas. And therefore, incidents like exhibiting anger, fury, openly, just because someone says something we don't like, or someone does not obey us, or someone does something we don't like, then, you know, we use our powers to victimize the person. This is a serious case of, child abuse. Because when you curse your children, basically, you are giving them real emotional trauma. And so, yes, majority of us have children, but we should not imitate Vishwamitra saying, oh, you child, you're a rascal. Because, for instance, majority of devotees who come to live in the temple, to take up a priesthood, parents don't even like it. But, you know, they have to do it anyway. But one may raise a question children are supposed to be subservient to their parents and just obey their parents, and that's it. Yes, it's true. But if you try to be a devotee and your parents are opposed to it, what will you do? You say, no, and I cannot be a devotee anymore. And so, the incidence of adoption, control of anger, and of course, spiritual involvement, they matter much in our everyday reality. In the case of high spiritual involvement, we see the benefits or the merits that accrued from the incidence of Asuna Sefa. How even he was given into debt, but even the demigods had to protect him. So Lord Krishna mentioned that a little advancement on this path could really save us from the worst type of cataclysm, worst type of devastation. And we see the example of Asuna Sefa. Just with high spiritual involvement, some spiritual advancement, cultivation of spiritual knowledge, he was able to make some prayers. And the more one is evolved, the more his prayers or her prayers could be very effective. And that is why, you know, people come to the mandi to tell the priest, please you pray for me. They tell the pujari, please you make some prayers for me. So those who are practicing every day, it's a different scenario, because you wake up every day, for instance, to come to Mangarati. You wake up every day when others are still sleeping, you are up chanting Krishna's names. So you're associating with Krishna, like associating with fire. If you associate with fire, you also become, you know, you acquire the qualities of fire. Because the priest is involved every day in some activities related to Krishna, he becomes empowered. And that is why people recognize that and they come to the mandi to solicit for help, prayers. And so that is exemplified here by the instance of Asuna Sefa having been saved by the demigods by making some prayers when he was given into debt. And of course, we know that adoption is something prevalent. But if you have children, talk it out with your children before you go for adoption, so that it doesn't create any conflict in the family. And then the other point is, we have to see how we are managing our anger. There is one book written by one medical doctor. The title is Anger Kills. Anger kills. And of course, Lord Krishna gives a very simple procedure how to deal with anger when someone comes to agitate you, or someone says something funny, or someone does something funny. When Krishna, Satyaki and Balaram, we are traveling, they had to sleep at some particular place when night took them. And they took turns to guide, you know, the rest. One person has to take to guide the other two people who are sleeping. So the first person was Satyaki, because he was very powerful. So he had to guide the place Balaram and Krishna went to sleep. And as he was guiding Balaram and Krishna, one Rakshasa came by and said, I'm a Rakshasa. I'm a man-eater. I can eat all of you, but I will save you. Just allow me to eat your friends. Krishna and Balaram. So Satyaki was very much enraged. And he said, how dare you say this? Those are my lords. And for having the impudence to tell me that, I challenge you to a fight. And Satyaki and this Rakshasa, they fought. Almost unending fight. And Satyaki became weak, even at the long run. But fortunately for him, Balaram has to take over the guy. But as they were fighting, the more Satyaki was angry, the more this Rakshasa was growing in height and in breadth. Until he couldn't even see the face. The face went into the skies. He became so tall. As he was, the more he was angry, the more this Rakshasa was growing, you know, was developing in size. So, when he got tired, Rakshasa, he left, and Rakshasa disappeared. So Balaram came to take over. He just went to sleep. Balaram came to take over the guard. And as Balaram came to take over, the same Rakshasa came to make the same plea or the same request that Balaram should allow him to eat Satyaki and Krishna. And Balaram also was angry. The same thing happened. Balaram fought with this Rakshasa, and Rakshasa again was increasing in size and height. Until if he fought Balaram, until Balaram also became very weak. Fortunately for him, Krishna has to take over. And when Krishna took over the guard, again the Rakshasa came by, and he made the same plea, the same statement, the same request to Krishna. He told Krishna, I will save you, but allow me to eat your friends. And Krishna just burst into laughter. This narration is there in, I think, in the Mahabharata. Krishna just burst into laughter. He laughed protractedly, and this Rakshasa was surprised. He said, I'm serious, and you're just laughing at me? So Krishna said, you're just in the mode of joking. He took him very lightly. And the more Krishna was laughing, the more this Rakshasa was reducing in size. Krishna just kept laughing, and he reduced in size, like up to the size of a sweet ball. So Krishna just put him inside his pocket. And so day broke, and everyone was awake. So they were narrating, you know, what happened in the night when they took turns to Guy. Satyaki first mentioned, Balaram also mentioned. And, you know, when it was Krishna's turn, Krishna said, you mean this guy? He brought Rakshasa from his pocket. You mean this guy? So they were all surprised what type of magic Krishna used. And, you know, the Rakshasa, he has made him a small ball. So Krishna explained that Rakshasa was actually anger personified, and gave the clue that, you know, it's just that when he came to him and he made that statement, he was laughing over it. He made the whole ridicule of the whole thing. And instead of becoming angry with the Rakshasa, he made it like a joke, and he just laughed over it. In other words, Krishna used laughter therapy to reduce the Rakshasa to the size of a sweet ball. So he told Satyaki and Balaram, that whenever someone comes to agitate you, how to deal with that, how to subdue that person's anger and subdue your anger, just laugh over it. Just laugh protractedly over it. Because the person comes with that type of anger, and when his intention becomes defeated, it becomes like, you know, when you put a puri in the oil, it's up. And when you bring it down, it becomes flat. You don't react. If you're just proactive, then, you know, that the person simmers down. But if you react with anger, you simply inflate the other person's anger. And then both angers will actually have some conflict. So, again, this is to show how all of the negative emotions that could trouble us, we have a clue. We have a solution to it. It's a matter of investigating the Vedic literature and take advantage of what is there. And when we do this, our lives could be very sublime in this very life. Not even the next life, in this life. So, we'd like to end here. Maybe there are some comments or some questions or some challenges about the discussions. And if there are no comments or questions, yes. Yes.
Thank you, Maharaj, for your wonderful class. Just, I wanted to get clarify on the subject matter, like you told about abuse and child abuse specifically. And there is also mention of punishment to discipline the child.
Yeah.
So what is the difference between these two things? Abuse and the punishment or the making the child discipline?
Yeah, that's a nice point. Now, there are so many things. For instance, in our own Vedic literature, there are so many things that right now we cannot do. I'll give you an example. It is mentioned in the Shastra that if someone blasphemes your guru, should cut his tongue off. Is it not? Can it cut off anyone's tongue now? Again, you know, the Manu Samhita, some of the laws in the Manu Samhita are like Sharia laws. And we can't adopt everything in the Manu Samhita. Therefore, whatever we are doing, we have to do it in consonance, in consultation with the constitution of that country. Because if we do some things that are anti-constitutional, the people, they are not religious people. The government is not a government. They are not spiritualists. They are simply, you know, mundane politicians or mundane lawmakers. Therefore, if we create our own bylaws that contravene the constitution, for instance, of India, we will always have so much of difficulties to deal with, even to preach to the people. So yes, we have to culture our children. We have to scold our children if they do wrong. But again, we have to see how and whatever we are doing is not in contradiction to the constitution of the country that we are living in. So that the child, you see, the children, when they go out, take for instance in America, the child, when they go to school, the first lesson is to call the police. the number that they have to call in case there's an alarm in the home. So it's a bad situation. It's a bad so-called civilization that children, instead of being groomed in how to become obedient to their parents, they are being groomed on how to become, you know, disobedient or to be rascally, even through peer pressure at school. Not only through peer pressure, but now even the government gives clue to the children what to do when their parents act in certain ways. Now, in the Vedic age, it wasn't the case. The child, is completely under the auspices of the parents. But nowadays, things are rapidly changing, in most cases, in a negative way. Therefore, we have to be highly adjustable. If we are maladjusted, we will run into trouble, all in the name of spirituality. And even our culture of trying to propagate Lord Chaitanya's message will be hampered. Take for instance, I remember when I was a president in Africa, precisely in Nigeria, you know, because of what transpired at some point in time, you know, I just made a policy that any boy, any girl, because, you know, outside of India, we take there are female ashrams and male ashrams in one temple. So I had a policy that if someone is not 18 years or above, I will not admit that person in my temple. Because by international law, someone is only independent from the parents when he's 18 or above. And therefore, if you keep a child under 18 in your temple, you're looking for trouble. because the parents can sue you. And then society will run into difficulty. So again, it boils down to the point that, yes, we have good intentions to preach, but we have to arm ourselves with the laws of the land so that the mission of Lord Chaitanya does not become impeded or impaired. So even with our children, we are very much obligated to groom our children properly, to tailor their activities in a way that they become dependent on people and people that could bring us good reputation to our family. But we have to know the limit, especially when the child attains pubescence or when the child attains puberty. So when the child attains puberty, that's between the age of 12, 13, 14, the brain is fully developed like that of a 50-year-old person. He may have he or she may have a small body, but when the child attains puberty, the brain is fully developed like that of a 50-year-old person, according to modern medicine. How do you deal with someone who is 50 years old? That should be the consideration. In most cases, people go into procreation, people go into marriage without even understanding or without even undergoing any iota of instructions on child development, how to take care of a child. And so therefore, we have to know what to do, at what time. At some point, even Chananke Pandit mentions that at some point in time, we should be friendly with the child. We give, we scold, we groom the child, we take care of the child, give instructions, but at some point in time, and that is within the age of puberty, at some point in time, if even the child does something wrong, we should call the child, sit the child down, and discuss the implications of that act to the family and to his or her life in the future, instead of simply bumping into the child and perhaps beating the child. And if you try those type of situations in some countries, the child will just call the police. I'll give you another gross situation. I was in Los Angeles in 2005. One friend invited me, and he told me how his daughter, under 18, in high school, the girl would sleep until about 7 o'clock in the morning or 7:30. So one day, she was on holidays. So one day he went to knock on the door. Your daughter. Is there anything wrong in knocking on the door of your daughter when she's oversleeping? You want the child to wake up early so as to read. You know what the child, what the daughter told the father? He said, "Dad, please don't try this next time. If you knock on my door next time, at this time, I will call the police." Because this is the way that we are cultured. If someone does something you don't like, call the police. But is that a culture to go by? No. That is practically what we're experiencing in modern times. Therefore, as a parent, we have to be wary how we take care of our children, not to overly react in situations. If even they err or they do something wrong, we should not overreact. We should be proactive. If we are proactive, the child will take cue and grow with that. So there are two things: reaction and proaction. A parent should be proactive. Okay. Any other comment or questions? Yes.
Krishna Maharaj.
Hare Krishna.
I just wanted to know, is it right for the children in this case to refuse the father's proposal, or is it correct for the father to bring home another child, adopt another child after having over 100 children was in the house?
Yeah, that's a nice point. And I think I raised that issue that adoption is not something new. And, you know, thousands of years or millions of years ago, these things were going on. And your question is it right or wrong? Now, we may not be able to evaluate right on the spot here, whether it was right or wrong. But like I mentioned, that if you ever think of adopting a child, and you have children already, or you have a child already, discuss it with your family. Discuss it with your family means not just your wife, but your children also. You see, we have a tendency. We have been hearing this philosophy when Krishna mentions that Everyone is his part and parcel. He didn't say only a matured man, only a matured woman. In other words, even children. And children constitute also your family. You remember the case when Nanda Maharaj was arranging, making so much of elaborate arrangement with other members of, other Nanda Grahamas about the puja. Huh? And Krishna was just watching them. They were making all sorts of arrangements. All here, they were so much hysterically moving around, preparing here. Krishna got fed up because he was not told about what is going on. But he considered himself as part of the family. You know, if you read that portion of the Bhagavatam, you'll be amazed how Krishna addressed Nanda Maharaj. He called his father very calmly and said, please, like, you know, we say modern day, daddy, please come. And he said, see, I'm your son here in this house. And as your son, I'm also your friend. You should not hide anything from your intimate friend. I'm your intimate friend. So you're making all these elaborate arrangements for Indra Puja. But I am here. And I don't know anything about what is going on. You're supposed to tell me what you're doing. I'm part of this family. What does that mean to us? These are statements in the Bhagavatam, in our scripture. Krishna was addressing a perceived emotional abuse. You see, the difficulty we have is we are not able to relate the scriptures into everyday reality. Krishna was addressing here a perceived emotional abuse. And he said, you read the whole of that chapter, Krishna addressing what it takes to be a good friend. Your responsibility is to a good friend. And he said, I am your friend. You should treat me like your friend. Don't hide anything from me. I'm part of this family. You're supposed to tell me also what you're doing. This is a small child. So, if you want to adopt a child, again, it boils down to that point. If you want to adopt a child, like Krishna will solicit that, discuss with your family what you want to do. Discuss with your wife and your children that you want to adopt a child. All of you should agree because you are not just alone in the family, despite the fact that you are the breadwinner. You are responsible to your family. See, sometimes we miscue. We think, I am the man. And we, the men, are chauvinistic, especially in India and Africa. Men are very chauvinistic. We have to discuss things with our family before we embark on any venture. Because if something happens to even the man, the sorrows, the pains, everybody in the family bears it. Is it not true? So why we claim to be independent to just bring some trauma to the members of the family when we can just easily discuss things with the family members, and if there's some trouble, everybody knows we all agreed on this. So the point is, we should discuss cases of adoption with our family members before we embark on it. And if the whole family agrees, good. Vishwamitra did not discuss anything with anybody. He came as a king, as a powerful personality. His duty was just to give orders. But if we adopt that order giving in modern day society, we will be paving way towards social disaster. Because we will have so much of disagreement, even with our own children, even with our own spouse, we will always have disagreement. And we'll say that I am experiencing so much of difficulty in this relationship because we're taking too much pain to do the things only on our own and make everyone our other carrier. It doesn't work in that way. Love does not operate in that type of system. We should desist from, or we should become a little bit maladjusted, because sometimes we'll get too much, we should become a little bit adjustable, because sometimes we get too much maladjusted and it causes trouble. So to be on the safe side, discuss issues. If you have a wife, You want to take that type of decision. You want to go and bring a child from outside to the home. Discuss with your wife and your child or with your children. If all of you agree, these issues will not be there. Of cursing. What will people gain by cursing someone? You evoke trouble. You bring a child to the world and you also give him trouble. What is the value? A devotee has to be compassionate. A compassion is different from, being sympathetic. They're two different things. Oh, it's a pity. You're just being sympathetic. Compassion means you put yourself in the shoes of that person, or you go in to help that person out of the situation. If you go to the etymological root of the word compassion, it is a deep meaning. If we have to see every member of our family as parts and parcels of Krishna, what is wrong in treating them like a devotee of Krishna? And will we say that the child is not inherently Sakshidananda because of the body? Our philosophy looks very simple, but it is very deep. So, in essence, yes, we should discuss the issue with our family before we go into adopting a child. Question is not whether it's wrong. We can see from the reactions that there is disharmony. It means a decision has brought disharmony. A decision has brought about cataclysm in the family. Our decisions in the family should be geared towards harmony and sustainability in terms of love and affection, not disharmony. If you go deep, again, this alone, it could be a whole day discussion about family sociology. So, you want to ask some questions? Yes, Prabhu?
Thank you, Maharaj.
Oh, wait, he wants to round it up. I want to round up his question. Yes, I round up your question. Peter, round up your question.
What I'm wondering is that I wonder what could make such a man as a Vishwamitra to go and adopt another child. Is it because the other children are rascals? Or
that's what it's not indicated in the Bhagavatam, okay? So I don't want to speculate. See, I've tried to make some research on Vishwamitra, but as I find so many contradicting things, I don't have the Vishnu Purana and the Hari Vamsa, which gives details of Vishwamitra. Those are authorized literatures. If you go and make some research about Vishwamitra and some other things, even just about his bed, there are so many contradictions. Even some other people, they say he had four children. But the Bhagavatam says 101. Bhagavatam is the cream of Vedic literature. So Bhagavatam is what we take. And so, that's what I don't want to speculate. I mentioned that earlier, that the motivation for his adoption is what remains a mystery to me. I don't know. Yes.
Thank you, Maharaj. You emphasized on harmony within the family.
How?
That means harmony within the family, so that we have to discuss our decisions within the family, arrive at a consensus before doing anything.
Sure.
But Maharaj, just looking at a situation, when you know that something is good in the interest of the family, and you propose that, supposing the rest of the family opposes because they don't see the way you look at that particular thing. So that means they don't agree with you, but you still feel that this is in the best interest and I have to do it. So that creates a conflict. How can that be resolved? Should we go with the family and not do something that you want to do?
That's a very important question. See, what happens, again, the laws. You see, better not to go into family life. If you're going to family life, it's full of complications. Someone should not be a householder and start to behave as if he's a brahmachari or as a sannyasi. See, I can carry my danda And then if I jump down from this ascent, I can tell you, I'm leaving for Delhi. I don't have anyone to consult with. A married man cannot just travel today that he's going to Delhi. He has to discuss it with his family. So if you're getting married, know that you cannot take decisions all alone by yourself. If you have to take decisions all alone by yourself, you don't need a family. You don't need it. If you need a family, you should know that the discussions are there should be a consultative forum. Because see, one thing is clear. Who is that husband who wouldn't want his children to be favorably disposed towards him? Would you like your children not to like you? Not to be favorable towards you? And I tell you, the only way you can make your children not to be favorable towards you is, you know, do something harmful to their mother. Or always pick holes with their mother. They'll be watching you. They may not say anything. But I tell you, like I narrated the story of those two boys. So, the point is, if we know something that is... If we know something that is going to be beneficial to the family, we should endeavor to educate the family. In fact, if you have any acharya, you see, in the Vedic age, if the wife is not cooperating, you just abandon your wife and take to vanaprastha. Okay? That may still be prevalent in India. But you try that in America, oh, your life is finished. Abandon your wife. But because the laws protect the women like anything. So, the point is, if you have a wife, you have children, you have good intentions, educate them on these good intentions. No one is just completely biased. Educate them with these good intentions. And I tell you, some people in the family will pick up your idea. And they will be able to convince the other members of the family. But whatever you intend the family to become, it should begin with you. It should begin with the individual, because I tell you, I have a friend. He came from India, one young boy. He came to marry from India, and then he went back to Detroit, to Michigan, in the U.S. And so he was pushing on the wife. The wife wasn't the devotee, but he was pushing on the wife to, you know, to chant. And the wife was very reluctant because she's from another background. You know, but then, you know, she kept pushing. But the wife was watching him, you know, chanting every day. But even him, he was not chanting even 16 rounds. But he was chanting like 8 rounds. But he was very serious, going to temple every day. And the wife was seeing that. So the wife, you know, was willing to also follow what he was doing. But again, you know, when you have this background, it's very difficult to deal with. But then, you know, later the wife just decided that, okay, this is a good thing. Why don't I just do it? So it took time. It took time. And this young woman, young boy, it took time. But you know the funny aspect of it? Is that when the wife decided that this is, okay, I'm going to do it, she started with 16 rounds. And the man was still chanting 8 rounds. So this went on for some time. And then one day, she called the husband. Sat him down and said, you see, Krishna gave you 24 hours. Now he wants only 2 hours from you, and you're refusing to give. How is that? The boy told me, right from that day, the wife raised that issue, he started chanting 16 rounds. Oh, yes. So, but did the wife develop the zeal to chant 16 rounds just over a night? No. They were having some psychological conflict about, you know, this spiritual involvement. But he persevered. He demonstrated with his own, you know, practical ways of life that, look, I care for you. I love you. Let's just do this thing. He didn't go into battle. He was preaching to him, but at the same time, he was caring for her and loving her. So again, it boils down to practical application of what we've been hearing in the sastra, in the scriptures. These stories are very illuminating. They're very uplifting. But we have to figure out, what do I go home with
from this story? What do I implement in my life to be able to achieve higher goals? So this is our whole process. The philosophy is there, but it's not, we're not just talking stories. That is why there is an application aspect of the knowledge. So yes, your point is very important. We have to see how we are educating the family. Thank you. Jai. Sri Sri Radha Gopinath ki, Jai. Srila Prabhupada ki.